Welcome to Mormon Expression Voices. We're back again today with a lady guest. Her name is Natalie, and I'm excited to talk to her because she has an interesting story that I think will pertain to a lot of people, but especially for women in general. So Natalie, do you want to start a little bit about your early Mormon background?
Sure. Hi. I was born and raised in the church. I grew up in Salt Lake County. And I am the middle of five children. My parents were also born and raised in the church. I grew up in a very typical Mormon household. I think I would call my parents semi-Jack Mormons, and that we attended church on a regular basis, but we didn't really talk about it at home. Like, we didn't have family home evening. I didn't even know what state conference was till I got to college. And people were like, it's time to go to state conference. And I was like, no, that's for leaders. We don't do that. So I think that they were very much social Mormons. Mm-hmm. They enjoyed the interaction with other people. Where I grew up, it was a very booming, lots of young families. So I think it was a very cultural theme for them. I think now they are believing Mormons. I really don't know where they were at when I was young. I remember in college, my dad said he wasn't sure. He didn't know if it was true. I think he's found his faith now. But growing up, they were very, very laid back, which was nice. I thought it was a great environment to grow up in.
So you were expected to go to church every Sunday, but it wasn't much pressure at home.
You know, and I don't even remember my parents threatening us to go. I enjoyed going. It wasn't until I was in high school that one time I left Sunday school with a friend and went to like Hardee's and got French fries, and I got in a lot of trouble, and I was like, oh, I didn't know that that was a bad thing. So we were expected to go, but my parents, certainly it wasn't like a threatening thing. It was just, this is what we do. It was a cultural thing.
And then as into adulthood, did you continue going to church?
Yeah, I ended up going to Ricks College after I graduated from high school. And that was hard for me. A lot of strict rules and regulations. I thrived there. I really enjoyed the atmosphere. I enjoyed the independence. The church was really hard, the rules. I remember I wore a pair of overalls and got in trouble by a teacher, because you're not supposed to wear overalls. I don't know why. They were really cute, too. And then I wore them again with like a jacket over it. And the teacher's like, yeah, I know you're wearing them. I'm like, but you can't see the straps. They're underneath. And he's like, but I know they're there. Well, that's weird. So it was just hard. I pierced my ears a ton because that was like the one thing I could do. So I kind of pushed the boundaries a little bit, but I enjoyed it. When I was in college, my second year, so I should back up a little bit. In high school, where I grew up, there wasn't a lot of issues. A lot of the people in my high school were LDS. So there weren't a lot of issues with kids dealing with like drugs and sex. And I'm sure it was there. It just wasn't a big thing. But I think one of the things that a lot of the kids struggled with was eating disorders. So when I was in high school, early college, I had a lot of self-esteem issues. I had a little bit of anorexia when I was in high school, and then in college, just from stress alone, I ended up being bulimic, and I ended up getting some counseling when I was at Ricks. I tried a counselor at home, didn't work out so well, went to college, found a really, really great one. So that was an interesting thing that I went through in college. I was in counseling, I think, twice a week, and then I moved to once a week, and it wasn't a huge amount of time, but it was an interesting parallel with my faith. I don't think I was ever, I had some depression as well, and I don't think I was ever suicidal, but I really strongly disliked myself. And I felt like at the time that the reason why I stuck it out and made it work and worked it out was because of my faith, because I had this fear of if I give up, there was this mentality of, oh, I'll go to hell. That would kind of suck. So I'm going to make this work. I'm going to stick around and try and get better, which I did. So for years after that, I had this kind of mentality of the church saved me. So no matter what frustrated me or was difficult, I feel like I owed it my life in a sense. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely makes sense. And I know from talking to other people that have suffered with bulimia and anorexia, they see a link between that disease and the strive to be perfect in church. Did you notice that yourself, or is it different?
Oh, yes. I am, when I decide to commit to something, calling, job, I am 110%. I'm like, I'm not only am I going to do this, I'm going to do a kick-ass job. Like, that's just the way I am, and that probably does have some relation to it. Like, I going to get in there and get it done. And honestly, that's one of the reasons why I always struggled so much in church, was because I would want to get in and do this amazing job, but for the most part, callings, you rely on other people. So if I get in to do a great job and then somebody else doesn't do the same, or lets me down or whatever, you kind of are setting yourself up to fail. So that was hard. That was hard in various callings that I had. But yeah, I'm very much like, get in there and get it done.
And you got the counseling at Rick's. I guess
did.
It was the LDS service.
Yep, she was LDS. You know, and the interesting thing is she didn't really counsel me so much on faith. It wasn't really a savior-based, you know, find your happiness. I did kind of come away with it with a mentality of, if I don't love myself, my savior does, which was really great at the time. It was nice to feel like there was some sort of power or being that cared about me regardless of how I felt about myself. So that was, I think, very helpful. But I think overall, it just gave me some counseling in general. It just gave me some really great kind of life skills to use throughout my life with other things I went to. I learned to let myself be hurt, you know, be sad and be hurt. It allowed me to recognize that sometimes there are behaviors that come from sadness. So I feel like I don't have a problem telling people I was in counseling, because I feel like I got so many great things out of it, and I'm a strong advocate for it when you're going through something really hard. So as difficult as it was, it was a really great growing up experience for me.
Great. I'm a strong advocate for therapy. Go get therapy, people.
Good stuff.
All right. So that was in Rick's. Anything yep. else you want to mention through college years?
When I graduated, I shortly beforehand, I met my husband. So we got married right after we graduated and moved to Provo, and we both continued school there.
And you met him at Rick's?
Uh-huh. Yep. Yep. We met there and we're in school for a little bit after. We started our family fairly young. We had our first daughter while we were living in Provo. And then shortly after, my husband got a job offer back east. So we took our cute little family of three. We just had this little baby and we moved back east. And we lived back there for, I think, 6 years. Had another child. We were there. And that was really interesting. It was kind of, in terms of the LDS church, it was kind of culture shock going there. And then again, culture shock coming back. Just such a different environment. You have a lot of first-generation Mormons where we were. So a lot of people just quite didn't know what they were doing, which was fine. It was great. It was a much more, I felt like it was a much more liberal environment. People were more accepting, for sure. Not cliquey at all, just very loving. We had a primary president once who taught a lesson to all the primary kids, and she was a convert. And she brought a picture of the temple and was talking to them about the temple. And I went and, you know, looked up at what she was doing, and it was a picture of the RLDS temple. So I had to go up to her afterwards and say, actually, that's not our temple. Good job. Great effort. So a lot of quirky stuff like that going on. But it was fun. There was a lot of young families, a lot of great friends that we made while we were there. Our second child, our son, was born in that ward. And when he was born, he had some gastrointestinal issues, some health problems. So he was a little bit developmentally delayed for a long time, for about a year and a half. And then when we finally kind of got on top of that physical issue that he had, we realized he had a lot of kind of behavioral and developmental issues. So he ended up a few months later being diagnosed with autism. So we have a cute little, well, he's big now. We have a cute son that's autistic. And that was really challenging with church. I should back up. When you have a child, you have expectations and things that you're excited about. And anytime you have a child that's diagnosed with a special needs, you have to let that go. And you go through this mourning process, and sometimes you go through it again and again, and it's just really challenging. He was very severe. He was diagnosed as kind of classically autistic, not high functioning. I would consider him a little bit more high functioning now. He's doing very well. But at the time, he had some self-injurious behaviors and no language. And so we kept going to church, and there just was no place for him. It was really, really hard. And people in our ward were very loving, and they wanted to help us, but they just didn't know how. So I had to really step it up and come up with kind of really toned down lesson plans, or just finally we had the idea of just calling him a teacher just to himself. And a lot of times she'd just be chasing him out in the halls. And so very loving people, but we really struggled with the whole idea of where is his place in this environment, in this culture. It got to a point where it was just so stressful. I mean, we would go every Sunday and he just would be unhappy. So we just kind of felt like, we just kind of felt out of place. We had, I think he was maybe 2.5, 3, where it just got to be so hard that we just said, we just can't do this anymore. So we took a couple Sundays off. And it was so delightful. We just decided to spend some time together as a family. So because we live back east, there was just so many fun things to do and places to go that we just took some family time on weekends and traveled. And it turned into from let's take a couple weeks off to a couple months off. So our cute little family of four just traveled around. And we started calling it the Summer of Us. And then for like years after that, oh, that Summer of Us was so great. But by the end of the summer, we had a count. We were feeling really guilty. We were feeling really bad. We didn't really have callings that we were neglecting. We just obviously weren't there. And they noticed our presence because it was a really small ward. So we had a counselor in the bishopric come over to our home. And he just started talking about how he had a son that had some developmental delays and just how much he needed the support of others and just, you know, expressed his love for us, and he started getting teary, and it made us just, it was so sweet and so sincere, and we felt his love, but oh my gosh, did we feel so guilty at the same time. We just felt like, oh, we're displeasing God, we're displeasing people that need us, and so we started going again, and it was, it didn't get better. I mean, there wasn't necessarily someone that came in and saved the situation with their son, but we just pushed forward and made it work. And then when he was about 4 or 5, we ended up moving back to Utah. My husband got a really great job offer back here. So we moved to Utah County. Again, nice little fun booming area. And we lived in our home, gosh, for about 6 months. So we didn't really have any big callings, just, you know, visiting, home teaching. Oh, no, my husband was called as the Elders Quorum president, I think.
When you were back in Utah?
Yes, yes. We, and maybe this is just because we had this son and we just recognized, sometimes people have needs outside of your comfort zone or what you're used to. But my husband and I are very loving people. We try to be. So we were in this new area and a lot of new homes and people were putting in their yards and people were, you know, trying to get to know each other. So he and I just naturally were out helping people, you know, let's help you get your grass in. Let's help you get your sprinklers in. Just trying to make friends, just trying to be good people. And I think the stake president noticed. Okay. So my husband had been serving as the Elders Quorum president and our ward was just growing like crazy and it was time for the ward to split and there was talk of a new bishop that they needed. And so sure enough, he called us into his office and my husband was extended the opportunity to be a bishop, which was so scary. So we had 3 children by then and okay, let me back up a little bit. So our son is autistic. Our daughter that's 2 years older, while we were back east, was diagnosed with sensory integration dysfunction. Have you heard of that?
Mm-hmm.
Not a lot of people have heard of that.
I've heard of it. Go ahead and explain a little bit.
She's very high functioning. And not that everyone that has it is, but that's what she is. She's typically developing. But she has a lot of sensory issues with like skin, hair, weather. So her sensory system's just out of whack. And we had really, really great intervention while we were back east with both of them, and they made really great strides. But it's something that she'll always have, that she'll always deal with. So, you know, I consider her special needs, even though she's very, very intelligent, very bright, and still is. Anyway, so we had those two. And then when we moved from back east back to Utah, we thought, oh, you actually don't have 2 kids here. Let's have another one. Need to fit in. So our third child is a girl, and she was born hearing impaired. And she's doing really, really great. She's mostly deaf in one ear. She hears really great in the other. So she's not to the point where she needs to use sign language, but it is obviously a challenge for her in some situations and stuff. Anyway, so here we have this little family and we have this baby that's hearing impaired and these 2 older kids that we're constantly, you know, we have IEPs and we have therapy and we have all these things going on. So we knew that the state president liked us. We knew he was aware of us, but we honestly did not consider ourselves candidates for this calling because, hello, who would call a family with 3 little ones, especially with this severely handicapped son? Apparently that's not how it works. So we called
there's no rest for the weary.
There's no rest for the weary. So he called us in. So I extended the call to my husband. And we, of course, accepted. And I remember that night when I called my parents, my dad said, Did you say yes? Why did you say yes? You should think about this. You should actually say no. Why didn't you say no? And I was like, that's not how it works.
That's an option?
Yeah. Yeah. Like, and it was honestly, I never had thought about that with a calling before because callings are from God, of course. And I just was so surprised that anyway, that was just a funny thing that he was like, well, you honestly, Natalie, you need to think about this. We're like, no, actually, you're not supposed to do that. You're just supposed to say yes and take it in faith. And anyway, so my husband served as a bishop for a little bit over 5 years. I have PTSD. I don't remember much of it. No, that's not true. I remember too much. It was really hard. It was really, really, really hard.
Hard in what ways?
Well, so many things. We had a very, very young, needy ward. Bless their hearts. Really great people. Love them so much. But a lot of challenges, both financially and spiritually and physically. There, for some reason, was a lot of kids with special needs in our ward. There was, we had a lot of situations where the news was reporting things, like we had a suicide. We had a murder-suicide. We had a, and we lived in a really nice area. I feel like I have to keep telling people, no, it was a nice area. We had a SWAT team that did it like a drug bust. We had people who, you know, one family that lost a child and a couple of, you know, elderly people that passed away and just really hard things. So, and I recognize that every ward is different and that some bishops' wives really thrive. And I wanted to be that person so bad. I wanted to be that wife that got out there and welcome people to the ward. I was so overwhelmed because he was just never home. And when he was home, he was on the phone and it was just, and he knew that I needed him and he just tried so hard and he did a good job, but it was just so hard. I really, really internally suffered. Because I missed him and my children missed him so much. And we ended up having a fourth child while he was serving. And it just felt like she didn't have a dad. And she was 2 or 3 when he got released. And they just did not have a good relationship. And I love to look at our lives now and see that that's been mended. And that they're just inseparable now. But for a really long time, she just wanted nothing to do with him. Because she just didn't know who he was. And I hated that. I didn't want that for my family. You know, I meet people now who say, oh, yeah, my dad growing up was a bishop and a stake president. I just don't really know him. I don't have a relationship with him. And it just broke my heart because here we're supposed to be so proud and so almost boastful of this job that we were doing, of this calling. And I was so proud of him. You know, this is the ticket to being a judge of Israel. This is the ticket to moving up the ladder. And I wanted that. I was proud of that. So I wasn't expecting, I knew it would be hard. I knew he would be gone a lot, but I wasn't expecting the resentment. I wasn't expecting the sadness.
Did you tell anyone of the emotions you were feeling?
I had a really great group of friends who knew that it was hard, but I didn't open up myself as much as I wished I could have. I had one really, really great friend. She had a son that was special needs too, and we spent a lot of time together. She was kind of my walking partner. And she came over one day and I just broke down and I just said, I just can't do this. I hate this. This is so hard. I want him to be released. And she just put me in my place. She just said, you just don't know what a great thing this is. Look at the blessings your family has. You know, she just kind of said, knock it off, toughen up. And I thought, you're right. You're right. I need to toughen up. And then
so did you see that advice as helpful or
you no, just, no, yeah. It was awful. It was the wrong thing to say. It really was. And I really, you know, thought she's right. I need to toughen up and interesting. We're not friends anymore. I didn't want to be your friend anymore. That's not what I needed. It's not what I needed to hear. I needed to hear, yeah, this sucks. It does suck. And I'm so sorry. You know, I love you and I'm sorry. And I telling someone to toughen up is never the right solution for any problem.
Yeah. It's just
she meant well, of course. She meant well. And I think, I can totally see where she was coming from her perspective. It is a privilege. It was. It was supposed to feel like a privilege. But it's not supposed to be painful either. So interestingly enough, I have some friends. I have one friend, particular friend. I made so many great friends, and I did have a lot of supportive people during all of this, and a lot of them have remained friends today. But one particular friend came up to me just a few weeks ago, and we didn't become friends until after my husband was released. And she came up to me and she said, "I have to apologize to you." And I said, "Oh, why? What happened?" And she said, "When you were the bishop's wife, I thought you were such a bitch." I was like, "Oh my gosh, what did I do? Did I hurt your feelings?" And she said, "No, Natalie, a lot of us thought that. You just were kind of in your own world. Like, you weren't, bishops' wives are supposed to be friendly. They're supposed to bring you the ward list. They're supposed to bring you cookies. They're supposed to be the mother of the ward. And you just focused on that little family, and you didn't ever smile, and you weren't nice. You weren't happy. You weren't making friends with anybody. You just were kind of mean." And I was like, she said to me, "I'm so sorry. I just didn't realize how hard it was and how much you were hurting." And I felt so bad. I didn't know that's the person I was being. I didn't realize that that's the person I was reflecting. And I'm sure there are people who would say, "Oh no, you were fine." But it was really hard. And I would so like to look back on those years of my life and say, we were so blessed and we learned so many great things. And maybe one day I'll get there. But right now, it still hurts. I'm not saying that I was this unhappy person the whole time. We have great memories, and there were great things that we did as a ward family. But I guess this is the best example I can give. We'd go to a ward activity, and I just wanted my husband to sit down and eat the crock pot dinner that everyone else was doing, but he couldn't. He had to walk around and mingle and socialize. And I just couldn't be the person who walked around with him, because I have four kids going in four different directions. And I always had big callings too, because they're just, a lot of people struggled with doing callings. So I always, at one point I was serving on the stake primary board. And at one point I was serving in the relief study presidency. So I always had a lot going on. There were nights where we had something church every night. Both of us. So we were farming out our kids and paying teenagers to babysit our kids so we could both go to church meetings. And that just seemed crazy to me, but it's what we had to do. But yeah, I look back on those years and I just am so proud of my husband for what he accomplished and the great things that he did. He was a really great bishop. He was very sympathetic, very incredibly loving. So that's great. And I feel like he growed in that place. And I'm grateful for the chance to support him in that role. But I would never, never do it again. Never.
Well, I can't imagine having 3 out of 4 children, young children with special needs, and having one calling as a bishop and a stake primary. That's just overwhelming.
It was. Yeah, it really was.
I can understand why you were focused on your own little family. It's all about survival at that point.
Yeah. So I had something unfortunate happen. And I think it was in the last year that my husband was serving as bishop. And we were really in survival mode for so long that we just kind of, well, this is actually just the way it is. We're not surviving anymore. This is our lives. But the last year was especially hard because, you see the light at the end of the tunnel and you just want to be done. So I think it was in this last year, my temple recommend was expiring and I needed to renew it. So sadly, this is one of the highlights of my husband's bishop service, was I got to go in and have my first temple recommend interview with him. So we just messed around and giggled the whole time. That was fun. And then I went and met with...
I never thought that the husband would have to interview
his wife. And I'll have to ask him. I can't remember. I think he signs his own recommend and then he goes and meets with the stake president. Yeah.
Oh.
But yeah, he interviews his wife. So the funny thing was he had scheduled the typical 10-minute window. And then he kept saying, "Okay, I have somebody else." I'm like, "No, I don't want to leave. Ask me more questions." Because I was just starving for his attention. And it was
date night for you.
It was date night. Shoot, I lost my temple recommend. Let's do this again. So after that, I went in to meet with the stake presidency. And I met with one of his counselors at the stake center. So I went in for my interview and sat down with his counselor. And, we'd had our pleasantries, and then he did the temple recommend interview.
Had you ever met this counselor before?
Yeah, he had been the counselor, not for too long. I can't remember how long. But yeah, we were friends. I had, you know, when you are a bishop's wife, you go to a lot of, not a lot, but there's occasionally there's a dinner with the bishops and the wives when an area authority comes to visit. They throw on a dinner, and he visited our ward a lot. So I would consider him a friend of, he was a friend of my husband's, and I definitely knew who he was. I didn't know him super well, but we knew each other. We were very comfortable around each other. And he was one of those kind of guys like, I know how hard this is. You know, he was very sympathetic to the role I was playing. And he had said a few things to me, you know, just politely. How's, you know, every time he'd see me at church, how are you doing? How are things going? And I just do the typical, oh, it's hard, but it's fine. It's going okay. It's hard. Anyway, so I went in for this interview, and after he did the typical recommend questions. So anyway, we were in this small classroom. We didn't have any windows. It was just like this tiny little table and two chairs, and there was no room for anything else. I don't even know if it was a classroom. It was a very small room just adjacent to the state president's office. So we went in this room, and I sat in a chair, and he sat. It was such a small room that he had to sit, like he blocked the door. He sat in his chair, and the door couldn't open unless he moved. It was so small.
Yeah, I think that's what describes in one of the newer stake buildings that do have small offices.
Yeah, it might have been like even just a store. Yeah, maybe it was an interview room or a storage room. I don't know, but it was a very, you couldn't put a classroom in there. It was very small. So after he asked me the recommend questions, he started to kind of, you know, visit with me more. And he just said, you know, how are things really going? And I didn't get teary. You know, I just said, they're really hard. This is really hard. And I know that my husband's, kind of getting to the end, and I know we're going to make it. It's going to be fine, but I just need to get there. I just need to be done with this. I need him home. I just look forward to him being home again. And he said, well, you know, I've been there. And I didn't know his history of past callings, but typically you have to serve something high up before you're in a state presidency, such as a bishop or something else. So he started telling me a story of when he was serving as a branch president in Hawaii. Maybe I shouldn't tell too many details of this story, but who cares? So I think that's what he told me. He was serving as a branch president in Hawaii. So he starts telling me this story about how he's serving as a branch president. And he said, you know, I had a wife and I had young kids, and it was just so hard. And I'm just kind of nodding my head. Yeah. Like, yeah, it is. And then he said, you know, he starts telling me a story, and he said, there was one particular evening. He said, I had been fighting with my wife for weeks, and we just weren't speaking, and we were just so angry with each other, and I just wasn't giving her the attention she needed, and she was resentful and really hurt. And he said, I just knew that I was doing wrong, but I just didn't know how to fix it. I couldn't fix it. I just couldn't. There's really nothing. He felt like there was nothing he could do. So he starts telling me about how his wife had made the decision that she either needed to save the marriage or be done, because she just mentally was done. So he said that he had a long night with meetings, and he came home, and instead of fighting like they normally did, she did the opposite, and she sexually pleasured him. She sexually met his needs so that he would feel better and treat her better. And I was like, what? Okay. And I just sat there just kind of staring at him, and I think he just thought, I'll just keep going. So he started to tell me in pretty good detail how she met his needs, and how that if I would let go of the sadness and anger and take care of my husband's physical needs, it would improve our marriage. So basically become sexually submissive to my husband. And I just sat there in shock, and he just kept going. He just kept going, saying, you know, sometimes as the wife, you have to step it up, and you have to be the one that makes things better. And I promise you, Natalie, that if you will pleasure him and take care of him intimately, he will treat you well. That was the message. And I was so confused, because it was my belief at the time that callings were from God, that these leaders, these high up leaders, the things that they taught and shared were based upon inspiration. So I just sat there and I thought, I can't believe that this is God's solution to my problem, that I have to let someone treat me poorly, that if someone is treating me poorly, that the solution is to pleasure them so that they will treat me well. I just was in shock. So he finished, and honestly, I wanted to run from the room, but I couldn't because he was sitting against the door. So he just, you know, he was done and he stood up and I left. I left. And as I left, I looked at the sick person's door and it was shut. I saw him going in there with someone else. So I just left. And I was just so confused because one, I thought, this is what God wants me to do. And two, I was so angry because I've always been 110%. I was a true believer and I've always done what I've been told to do. But I couldn't do this. I couldn't. I just knew it wasn't the solution because what happens the next time he doesn't treat me well? I have to do it again. And it just wasn't a solution that brought me happiness. So I went home and I didn't tell my husband because somehow in my mind I thought it's possible that he knows about this. And it's just crazy that I had this thinking at the time, but I thought, what if he set this up? Or what if he just made a remark to this member of the state presidency? You know, what if this is what he wants? So it's just so ironic to me that this message that he had of here's how to fix your marriage actually made it worse because I went home and I was just so angry and resentful. And I didn't talk about it. I didn't want to talk about it. I just was so overwhelmed. I felt like I was treading water. I had been treading water for years. And instead of throwing me a life jacket, this man threw it and knocked me out, hit me in the head. I still think today, he seems so loving and sincere when he said this to me. And I just wonder, I mean, obviously he has some really messed up ideas of how a marriage works, but he believed in his message and he really believed in what he felt like he had to share. So were his motives sincere? I don't know. He probably got some weird kick out of it. I don't know. I don't know how sincere he was. I hope that I would like to believe that he really meant well. I really would. And part of me does think that, but his intent was to do one thing and it did the opposite. It just made things even harder. So I didn't know what to do. I didn't know who to tell. I didn't know that if I telling my husband would do me any good because, you know, who's to say he's not going to turn around and say, yeah, that actually, and honestly, that probably would fix things. It probably would make things better because that's what we needed. We needed more time together. We needed to reconnect. But within a few weeks, I noticed that just kind of naturally on our own, we realized that things were hard. And this is just the life of a bishop's wife. It's just like a wave. You just flow up and down where you recognize that things are hard and then you come back together and you just go through it over and over again. At least for us, that was very typical. So within a few weeks after that, they made a change in the stake presidency and he was released. Actually, I think it was within a few months. It was a few months later. And I kept thinking, I need to tell someone. I need to tell someone that this is something that happened. But I didn't. I couldn't because I was so embarrassed. I was so embarrassed. I think that I've never been sexually harassed by someone like in the workplace. And that's an awful thing to happen. Oh, this is so hard to explain how I feel. If that happens to you in the workplace, I'm not saying it's flattering that somebody came on to you, but they did. They found you attractive. And for me, I was sexually harassed, and I am calling this sexual harassment, and it took me a long time to realize that's what it was. It was different because he wasn't even coming on to me. He wasn't like attracted to me. He just thought, he was just telling me sexually I wasn't good enough in what I was doing with the person who was attracted to me. So I was just so embarrassed. I was so humiliated that I wasn't meeting, apparently, my husband's needs. And the other hard thing was, a member of his immediate family was in our stake and was a friend of mine. So for me to come out and say what happened, I would lose that friendship. And it would completely blow up this circle of friends that I had, because she and I were in this close group of friends. So I just held it in. I held it in. And I just buried it. I buried it just so deep and just thought, this guy's just an idiot and he's just messed up and whatever. It's just, I'm just going to. But at the same time, after a while, I just kind of mentally let go of it. But at the same time, for the first time in my life, I had said no to God. That was my thinking. For the first time ever.
Was that a feeling of power, a feeling of guilt?
No, horrible, horrible guilt. And I think the reason why it was such a big deal to me was because every time I went to the temple, it was basically the same message. Your husband is the head of the household, and you report to him and he reports to God. And let's be honest, that's not a lot different in terms of submissive behavior. So in my mind, what he told me, as stupid as it was, like as messed up as it was, I had heard it before. It wasn't that different of thinking in terms of what I was being told both at church and in the temple, that it is my job to meet my husband's needs, because that's what I do. I mean, we had a situation where my husband was offered a new job and he wanted to stay where he was and I wanted him to take it. It felt like a better opportunity to me. He felt like he was happy where he was. We said, let's go to the temple and maybe it will help us decide. And we came home and he said, what did you think? And I said, it doesn't matter, because when I went, the inspiration that I got was, I'm supposed to do what you want to do. That's the message. That's the feeling I got. Anyway,
I just want to kind of reiterate for people that may be wondering, what is the big deal about what you went through in this little room in the office, especially some gentlemen that might not understand. As women in the church, you're taught to be submissive to the priesthood head. We don't talk about sex. And then you're put into a little room with a man, and you're even told not to be alone with men except your husband. And now you're in a little room with one man. You can't get out if you wanted to. And not only is he asking you questions about your own personal worthiness, you believe he has a spiritual discernment over you and knows your deepest thoughts and maybe even things you don't even know about yourself. And in the temple, you're taught that you can't get to heaven unless you're through a man.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So you're put into a very vulnerable position. And then for him to come out of the blue, totally unexpected, to talk about sex, even if it wasn't sex about the two of you directly.
Yeah.
It makes you feel very vulnerable.
Certainly. It made me feel incredibly insecure in the role I was playing as the wife and the mother. I was trying so hard to do everything I was supposed to do that I didn't even know that this was something that I was supposed to be doing as well. Was just meeting those physical needs despite how I was being treated at home. And there was no abuse. There was no, like, my husband was a very loving person, but I wasn't getting the affection and the attention that I needed, like anyone needs in a marriage. So it obviously, what is not a solution, but that's what I struggled with, is it just at the time did not feel like the right solution. And I just really struggled that this is what God wanted me to do. So about, my husband was released like a year later. And then about a year after that, when he was released, it was so great. We were so happy. We just felt so free. But at the same time, there were things that we didn't realize would be hard. And again, it was such a needy ward. There were a lot of people that we were friends with that I know had conversations with my husband, or he was helping them with things. And it was fine. He did a really great job at it. He was very loving and they felt that and they appreciated that. But when he was released, the thing that we weren't expecting was this sense of, oh, we actually don't want to be your friend because you know all of our dirt, kind of a thing.
Oh, yeah. I never thought of that.
Yeah. So we found that it was really hard. We had all these great friends, and then he was a bishop, and we had no friends for, I mean, we had friends, but we just weren't horribly social people for a really long time because we were so busy. And then he was released, and we're like, okay, we're ready to be friends again and play and have fun. And everyone was like, no, now you know, like, all these things about me, and it's really awkward. And so all of a sudden, here we were in this little community that we loved, and we just felt so isolated. We felt like people were still calling him bishop. People still respected him as a bishop, which is so great. But at the same time, we're like, no, we just want to be normal people again.
And they're thinking it's like going to dinner with their gynecologist.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Very much so. You've seen my internal parts. Thank you very much. Yeah. So about a year later, and I just was still internally struggling with this whole thing. And I don't want to give the message that this is all I could focus on and think about was this one experience. I really did mentally just bury it and just kind of let it go, thinking that this guy's just a schmuck. Because eventually with time, I realized my marriage has gotten better and I didn't do what I was told to do. I did my own thing and maybe God's mad at me. I don't know. But it's working. Like whatever I'm doing, like we're figuring things out. Things are getting better. I just did it on my own. So as soon as my husband was released, things were actually really great in terms of our marriage and the two of us. Anyway, so about a year went by after he was released, and we just said, you know what? Maybe it's just time for something new. It's time for a change. We had four kids. We were starting to outgrow our home. We wanted to live a little bit closer to where he worked for his commute. So we started looking at homes, and we ended up moving to Salt Lake County. And we thought it'll just be so great to have a fresh start in a new ward. So I think this was about 2 years after my whole sexual harassment experience. So we started going to this new ward, and within it, really loving, friendly people were always coming over. So about a week after we moved in, the high priest group leadership presidency, whatever you call them, came over. It was like three men. They came over and they sat in our front room and visited with my husband and I had a panic attack, and I was like, what is wrong with me? And I realized that after that happened to me, any other interaction I had, first of all, I never had another interview that I allowed myself to go to after that. I didn't go to the temple. He pretty much screwed up me ever wanting to go to the temple again, because going to the temple meant envisioning this interview I had. And so that was pretty much screwed up. So I just stopped my temple attendance. I'm just like, yeah, I'm not going anymore. I'm done. Which I don't think necessarily that was a good or bad thing. It's just how I mentally reacted. Anyway, so I was very careful in our old ward where we were living at the time with who I interacted with. You know, I was much more protective of myself. You know, I actually don't want to be alone with somebody. I'm going to be careful not to. And it's not that I never was. Like when my husband was released, we had a new bishop, and he was this older gentleman that I knew well enough to not be concerned. So when he would give me callings, I would go in there by myself and I knew it was fine. But when we moved to the new ward, I realized I don't know anybody. I don't know anything about them. I don't know if I can trust them. I don't know if I can be alone with them. And I just freaked out. So I sat down my husband and I said, here's what happened 2 years ago. And I can't do this right now. I can't. I'm supposed to go meet with the new bishop. I think he wants to give me a calling, and I can't go in that room and be alone with him. I can't. And my husband was like, why didn't you tell me this happened? And I just said, I don't know. It was just so hard, and we were just so drowning. And he was very loving and very supportive. But what I didn't realize is how hurt he would feel, because this was somebody who, even though they weren't my friend, it was someone I knew, but we weren't friends. He was friends with them. It was somebody that he had gotten to know through meetings and through interacting. And he was just so hurt and, of course, angry and defensive of me. And so I said to my husband, I think I need to tell somebody what happened. I think I need to just let people know, or let our new bishop know, not because I'm trying to even to report it, but just because I want him to know that right now I just can't do what I need to do. I can't do the typical get a calling, interact with other people. I just mentally can't do it. So we went and sat down with our new bishop, and actually we just kind of stopped going to church for a couple weeks. And I said, you know, I want him to know what's going on. I don't want him to think we're, because somehow he found out that here's this, you know, retired bishop and very religious, great, you know, active family coming to his ward. And he's like, where are they? So we sat down and he said, oh, I'm so glad you came in. Yeah, we've been worried because we haven't seen you for a couple weeks and we're just wondering what's going on. So I told him the whole story and I just sobbed. I just was so embarrassed. And I just, you know, I said to him, is this normal? Is this, am I correct in thinking that that was inappropriate? And he's like, oh yeah, that's not normal. That shouldn't have happened. And so I just said to him, I just mentally need a break. You know, maybe we'll keep coming to church. Maybe we won't, but I'm not accepting a calling right now. And that was a hard thing for me. That's the first time I've never turned down a calling. I just grew up that you don't do that. So that was really, really hard for me to just say, I don't want to be given a job. I just want to heal. I need to heal. I need to unbury this and deal with it and just move on with my life and learn to trust people because, you know, I didn't even realize that I didn't. So he said, that's fine. He's like, you know, how long of a break do you want? And I said, I don't know. You know, maybe we'll come. Maybe you'll see us a few weeks. Maybe you won't see us for a few weeks or a few months. I just let you know this is where we're at. And he had a lot of great questions. And I brought my husband with me. I didn't want to be alone with him. So my husband came in with me and we, you know, I said to him, just be a fly on the wall. And he just sat there and held my hand. And we just talked. And then this is our new bishop. He actually had a lot of great questions. You know, he said things like, you know, how's your relationship with your Savior? And I said, you know, I'm fine there. I don't feel like, he's like, are you praying? And I said, oh, of course. You know, I'm just, you know, asking for help and just getting through this. And he gave me a challenge. He said, if you're not going to be coming to church, that's fine. But I'm going to challenge you to study the life of the Savior and study the history of the church and strengthen your testimony. Recommit yourself to the Savior, you know, things like that. Just find peace and healing through the Savior. I said, oh, that's actually a really great idea. You know, and then he asked me, do you, want, you know, have you thought about getting some counseling? And I said, I can't deal with that right now. Yes, that's probably something I should do. You know, I just felt so stupid. I'm like, it's just not that big of a deal. What happened? But yet it's really messing up my life. Anyway, so I went home and I said, you know, that's a really good action plan. I'm going to, oh, and he also encouraged me to write a letter. He said, you know, you need to let your old stake president know what happened. You really do. And I said, yeah, okay, you're right. And he was somebody that we just love, that both my husband and I had formed a really great relationship with, and we just adored him. So I sat down and I thought about calling him. I'm like, no, I'm going to actually document this. I'm going to sit down and just let my heart pour out all of my thoughts. So I sat down and I wrote just a 1-page letter. You know, I'm so sorry I didn't tell you this earlier, but here's what happened. I just feel like you should know. And I really felt like it was a good part of the healing process. So I mailed the letter to him. And of course, a couple of days later, he called me. And I really thought that talking to him would make me feel better, but it actually made me feel worse. So come to find out from him, we talked on the phone for a while. He said, you know, I just want you to know that this happened to 6 other people. And it was actually the reason why he was released from his calling. And he said, it was so bad that they brought in an area authority to, what's the word?
Cover up?
Maybe. No, to investigate. Sorry, okay. I had a brain freeze. They brought in an area authority. That's kind of what happened. They brought in an area authority to investigate the whole thing. And then he ended up being released. Because come to find out, the state president shared with me, it had happened to someone before me, and they immediately reported it, and they warned him and said, this is inappropriate. Don't do this again. And the state president said to me, you know, he really believed he had a message to share. He really believed in his message. He really thought that if, in general, women would meet their husbands' sexual needs, it would improve relationships. He really believed in that. And he said to me, from, you know, we talked for a while, and he said, from hearing your story and reading your letter, I think that you were probably the worst situation. He went in the most intimate detail. And there was a lot of detail as to how his wife pleasured him. It was weird. But he said, I think this is because you were a bishop's wife. So he felt like you had that, you know, thing in common. And he obviously felt you hurting in your, you know, current marital situation. And he said, you know, I remember you going in for that interview. And he said, you left really quick. And you were in there a really long time. And he said, I went up to him afterwards and I said, is everything okay? And he said, yeah. And he said, you know, if someone is confessing a sexual sin to you, he assumed that's what I was doing, confessing something, because we were in there for so long. He says, if someone is confessing something to you, any kind of nature, but when he talked with me on the phone, he said, if anyone's confessing it, like a sexual sin, they really should be talking to me, not to you. And he said that he turned to him and said, okay, it's good to know, and walked away. So the state president felt awful. I mean, he was literally in tears on the phone. He just said, I'm so sorry. I feel still responsible for this. And I said, no, you know, we love you. You're our good friend. We know this isn't your fault. But I really thought I would feel better afterwards. And I felt worse because in my mind, I thought, oh my gosh, this happened to other people after me. And I could have prevented that. I could have stopped that. And I didn't, because I didn't speak out. I just thought this was dumb and stupid. And even though, you know, I thought this is what I was supposed to do, I just, you know, I just had so much guilt. And all of a sudden, after 2 years, it was just all coming back up again. It was like I was going through it all over again. So I said to him, when he was investigated, what happened? I mean, obviously he was released, but what did they decide to do? And he said, well, they felt like they released him, but they didn't put anything on his church records. They didn't do anything beyond that because they felt like it would ruin his life. Like he would be tainted for the rest of his life in the church. And I just thought that was so interesting. That there's nothing that's been set up to prevent him from having these conversations again because they felt like it would ruin his life. So what about the people he harassed? What about the people that he hurt? I don't know.
Well, it kind of negates any of their feelings.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it just made me feel like my situation, you know, slap on the hand. That was, you know, you did something bad, but there's nothing set up to stop him from doing that again. And I was there. He really believed in his cause. So I don't know how they're going to change that. I just think it's so interesting that we take people who are in a same-sex relationship and it's on their paperwork. Can't work with children. You know, can't have certain callings. And yet here's somebody who intentionally sexually harassed multiple people, but we just don't want to ruin his life. We don't want to hurt him. I don't know.
I'm so asterisk by his name.
Yeah. Yeah. I just thought that was really interesting. So after that, it was the pursuit of finding my faith again, finding my testimony again. So I thought, you know, I actually feel like my relationship with my Savior is really great. I want to refine my faith in the church. So I thought, I'm going to start from the beginning. I'm going to start reading church history.
I feel like there should be scary music in the background right now.
I feel like I could end my
story. Open the door.
I feel like I could end my story now because we all know where it's going. So my husband had read a book called The 19th Wife like months before and said it was really good. He said that was a really interesting book and he didn't really go into detail. But I thought, oh, that's about pioneer wife, or one of Brigham Young's first, or not first, but one of his many wives. So I read The 19th Wife, and it's by Anne Eliza Young or something. I can't quite remember her name.
I think that's right.
Is that right?
Yeah, I think it is.
Awesome. So she's obviously very hurt and very bitter through the whole thing. But if you can get beyond that, it's an incredibly good book. And I read the book, and I finished it, and my sister came over like 5 minutes later. And I said, I just read the most incredible book about Brigham Young's wife. And she goes, oh, is it really good? I said, no, it's awful. And I turned to my sister and I said, I really, truly believe that Brigham Young is going to hell. There's just no way around it. There's no way that man is going to heaven. He was such a horrible person. And he treated his wife so bad. Oh my gosh. Just how he took other people's wives or how he manipulated people. I was dying. I just couldn't believe. And is the book true? I don't know. She wrote it and people confirmed it. And
well, even if you take the fact that she was an angry wife.
Yeah, it doesn't
so
change.
You throw out 50% of her stuff.
Yeah.
There's still
a lot of good stuff there. Anyway, so I finished. I thought that was really interesting. I thought, okay, I need to get back. I honestly, it like, I was like, oh my gosh, I got to go back further. I got to start with the beginning. So my husband and I were talking a lot about, you know, belief and church history, and he was just so respectful of where I was at. You know, it was never like, well, guess what else happened? No, he was just like, okay, well, what do you want to read next? And we happened to go out to lunch with a friend who was like, oh, Natalie, I have the best book for you to read. And I said, well, I don't want to read anything anti-Mormon. He's like, no, this was written by someone who taught seminary for like 30 years. And he does a really good account of church history. It's kind of like church history for dummies. Cause I tried reading Rough Stone Rolling and my brain just couldn't, oh my gosh, I just kept falling asleep.
I'm glad to hear I'm not the only
one.
Oh
my gosh. I've tried so many times and oh my gosh. So he said, you need to read Grant Palmer's book, which is, oh gosh, help me. The
I can't remember either.
Insider's View of Mormon Origins.
Right.
Yes. So shame on him for opening the gate to my.
And this is a true believing Mormon?
No. Oh, okay. He left the church.
Oh, he saw his opportunity.
Oh, he sure took advantage of that. And you know what? I thank him every day for it. So I don't think he was being malicious at all. I just think he just saw, that I was struggling. He was like, well, here's the thing. It's not an anti-Mormon book. I don't feel like it is. I feel like it really is a very loving. Okay. Here's how I relate personally to Grant Palmer. I want to believe. I want it to be true. Because not because it's perfect and I'm happy within it, because I've just dedicated my life to it and it makes sense to me. And as hard as I'm working, I like the outcome. I want it to be true. So I sat down and read Grant Palmer's book, and he talks about so many things that I had never heard of before in the history of the church, the multiple accounts of the first vision, how Joseph Smith translated the Book of Mormon with the hat and the rock. I'm like, that's not real. That's actually not real. Yeah. Yeah. So and this is what I love about his book, is he tells it very, you know, he explains it so well, like so simply, which was so great for my brain. And he has so many, I mean, I swear it's like the Bible. There's so many references. There's more references than text. He just was really good about sharing, you know, documentation and fact. And so it's not like it just spewed out of him. He shares where he got all of his information from. And then I got to the chapter about the book, The Golden Pot. Do you know about that?
Isn't that the story that kind of aligns with Joseph Smith's vision?
Yeah. And I won't go into detail about that, but if you don't know what The Golden Pot is, you probably should figure it out. So basically it's a book that is kind of the same storyline as Joseph Smith and him restoring the church.
It has a lot to do with Joseph Smith's vision with Moroni in his bedroom.
Yeah. Yeah. So that was shocking to me. You know, the Smiths being treasure seekers, I didn't know anything about that. The whole terminology of not actually seeing things, but seeing them with your spiritual eyes. I've never heard that explained to me before. Just plagiarism with the Bible, just all of the scriptures that were just identical and a few words that were tweaked. That was really fascinating to me. So I read through the whole book, and then I sat down and I read through the whole book again. And I just really was in shock. I can't believe, I mean, just everything just crumbled. Everything just crumbled. And part of me was just so damn relieved. I've just worked so hard and I've given this so much and I've struggled with so many things.
That's the weird thing about that book, I thought, is there were things that I always questioned in my mind, thinking, you know, that doesn't really make sense, but it's church, so I'll go with it.
Yeah.
And then you read Grant Palmer's book and you're like, oh, that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep. Yeah. Like there was just so many things that I struggled with, especially with, I'm very much a feminist in that I don't understand why the funding is so unequal in like young women's and young men's. Like I honestly, someone explain it to me again, because why when you turn 8, the girls get half as many activities and a quarter of the funding? Like I don't understand. Someone explain that to me. That makes no sense to me. So there were always issues and inequalities that I really, really struggled with in the church, but it was true. Just, we have to make it work. We have to make it work. So when I read that book and my faith and belief just crumbled, I went to my husband and I said, first, don't pay any more tithing. Stop right now. He's like, oh, okay, why? And second, I'm done.
Had he read the book?
No, but he had heard things about like the hat, translating with the hat. And there were things that he knew about that he just kind of blew over because I think he just felt like we were making it work. And I think he had a testimony of it. He believed in it. But he saw how unhappy I was. And honestly, maybe at the time he was just saying, okay, whatever you need, just to help me get through what I was going through. But then, of course, I started to share things with him that I had learned about. And he was like, oh, wow. So he took it upon himself to start searching the internet for things that we had talked about. And just every night we had just these, we'd go to bed and, okay, what did you learn today? We had these just in-depth conversations for weeks. And it just started to crumble for him too. And I was very fortunate in that he listened and he didn't get defensive because look at his life. He'd been this amazing bishop and this prestigious person within that ward. And, you know, people really loved him and respected him. And part of me felt so bad because I was kind of taking that away. And I didn't want to be the partner that ruined a belief for someone else. But he was very loving and understanding in the way he listened and, you know, just continued to support me and love me. And honestly, it had been hard for him too. And I think that he was living in survival mode during his years of being a bishop for so long. Then when we got back to being a normal little happy family, he realized how hurtful it had been. He realized that, especially his relationship with our youngest, how bad it was because she just didn't know who he was. So I think as hard as it was for him to hear the things I had to say, he recognized the good that our family had and the bonding that we had done in that short amount of time and just how much happier we were, just how much of a happier family we were. And I started to recognize so many things within myself that I didn't like, that I felt like the church had just built upon me, like the way we gossip and talk about other people, the way we treat other people who question or leave the church. And ironically, I knew that that's what would happen to me. And it has. People have not been nice. People have gossiped and talked about us. And you know what? It's fine. What can I do? I did the same thing. I'm guilty of the same thing. When he was the bishop and somebody wouldn't attend and I served as the young women's president, I'd go to the family store and, you know, I wasn't being judgmental. I was in the most loving way ever. Like, I really want to help you get to the celestial kingdom. I really want to help you on that path. And little did I know that, you know, some of these families probably knew what I know now and just wanted to be left alone. But anyway, so, this was a couple years ago. So where we're at now, again, back to the, I'm 110%, like I'm in or I'm out. So I got to the point where I just started to recognize how unhealthy the doctrine was for my children. So I sat down with my husband and I said, I want to resign from the church and I want the kids out too. And he said, Okay, whatever you need to do. And this is hard because I feel like when I tell people my story, they think that I left because someone did something to me, because they hurt me. And they did. And that's what led me on this path. I don't really have an answer for that. I've left because the doctrine that I have studied is not true. Obviously, that person hurt me and I stayed for several years. So those are two separate things. Yes, that situation led me on the path that led to me leaving, but that's not why I left. And for me, that's important for other people to understand because they're not the same thing. And I know a lot of people in my immediate family feel like that's why I left, because somebody offended me. And that's not true. I mean, yeah, he did, but I left because I don't believe in it anymore. I studied and learned and grew and came to understand that it wasn't true, that I don't believe it's true. So I, myself and my children have resigned. My husband has not. He is incredibly, I'm not going to talk about where he's at in terms of belief because he has his own story to tell when he's ready. But none of us are currently going to church and he is incredibly supportive and loving towards where I'm at. And it's a roller coaster. I don't ever want to go back, but there are still things that are really hard to go through when you leave because you know, the principles of marriage and raising a family and all of these things start to crumble. So we're just slowly building our foundation. And it's a weird thing in your 30s, in your late 30s, to be like, well, sorry, kids, we don't know what we believe.
Can I ask you how you brought that subject up with your children?
Our youngest is 5. And then, okay, so our oldest is 15, and then we have 13, 8, and 5. The younger kids, our son is the one that's 13 that's autistic, and then our two, we call them the little kids and the big kids. The little ones were like, we said we're going to take a break from church, and we didn't even talk to them about belief in the beginning. We just said, we just feel like it would be good to spend time together as a family, and they couldn't have cheered any louder. I mean, honestly, ask any kids that are active, how would you like to not go to church today? That sounds great. So they were totally fine with it. Our son was totally fine with it too. He's again, back to the having a handicapped child. He's always struggled. He's never had a place. There's never been a good place for him. And that's a whole nother podcast in itself, special needs kids in the church. It's just really hard. But our oldest is a little bit of an introvert. She's just the most beautiful, loving girl, but she's a little bit shy. So she was fine with it because I feel like moving to a new ward was really hard for her to, you know, to push herself out there and make friends. So she was fine with it, but we did sit down with her and say, you know we're grown-ups and we're supposed to know what's true and what's not true, but here's what we've read and here's how we feel about it. You know, we feel a little bit hurt and deceived that this gospel that we've believed in, you know, isn't being forthcoming and all of these things. And she just listened, and she's very, very bright. So we shared a few things with her. And like with any, you know, kids, you allow them to ask the questions and you follow their lead. And so she had a lot of great questions, and she was actually just fine with it. There were no tears. There was no sadness. She said, okay. And then we've just made a really good effort she's probably feels like it's excessive, but every month or two I'll sit down. I'll just go down to her room and say, you know, I read another good, interesting thing, or here's where I'm at with this. And she'll just say, okay. And we said to all four of the kids from the very beginning, if this is something you still want to participate in, we are 100% behind that. If you want to go to church on Sunday, we will go with you. We do have a hard rule that you can't ever be in a room alone with somebody, which, let's be honest, that should be a rule for everybody anyway. So that's just something that we've always thought was a good rule in general. But we said, if you ever want to go to activities, that's great. Our 8-year-old did want to go to activity days, and we allowed her to go for a couple weeks. And this is just one of those situations where it really does depend on the leader. I'm sure there are a lot of inactive families that let their kids go to not Sunday, but weekly activities that do just fine. And that's great. But she just happened to be paired with a leader who was very rigorous in church doctrine. And I asked her, this is when we were inactive. This was not before I officially resigned. I asked her to I said, would you please give me a schedule of your agenda so I know what you're talking about and teaching every week? And she did. And then instead of teaching on nutrition 1 week, she taught about modesty, and she took it too far. So I said to my 8-year-old, you know, she came home and she felt like what she was wearing was not appropriate. And I said, okay, you're done. You're actually done. We'll fill this void with something else. We'll find something else fun for you to do. And we have worked on that. And I just, you know, we said that in the beginning, and now we're a little bit more strict with we would prefer you not to go. If you absolutely, and once in a while, my oldest will go to Young Women's because they're doing, you know, a fun kind of activity that's not, doesn't feel religious. And, you know, there's prayers and there's probably some sort of religious discussion, but she's really good at navigating that. And so we still tell our kids, you're entitled to believe what you want, and we'll support that. And we're really good about not expressing, you know, frustration or hatred, which I don't think we have, but we're really careful about how we speak in front of our kids. The funny thing is, when we were true believing Mormons, we just wanted, studying the doctrine was just tedious. And now we can't get enough of it. I'll read anything you put in front of me. And we watch conference. We just think it's so great. Not because we're being judgmental, because we just find it fascinating, this culture that we were so engrossed in. It's kind of like, we joke all the time that it's like the movie The Matrix. We swallowed the pill. We swallowed the pill, and we're seeing it now with different eyes, and it is fascinating. So we have extended family that is still very much involved in the church. And when we get together with them, we'll invite them to pray in our home, or we'll, you know, we went to sacrament meeting today to support someone. So we're very much open and willing to do things like that. But for the most part in our home, we believe in humanity. We believe in happiness. We believe in serving other people. We believe in loving and supporting each other. There, but beyond that right now, that's just where we're at. It's just what we're focusing on. And we're just living such simpler, happy lives. Sure, things are still hard. Sure, we still have hardship and, you know, things go up and down. Like, it's just life. Life is hard. But I love seeing my kids thrive. And I love having more control over what they're learning. I love that everything they're learning about their physical bodies and about intimacy with other people, I have complete control over. I love that I'm the one who's answering the questions. I love that I'm the one who's guiding them and helping and shaping. You know, I'm so much more aware of what they're thinking and doing and feeling because I'm not letting somebody else raise them anymore. I'm not sending them off for someone else to teach them about modesty. I'm doing it in an open, loving environment where I'm letting them, for the most part, make decisions on their own and encouraging them as to what I think is appropriate. You know, we're not trying to be our kids' best friends, but we're just such better parents right now. We feel like we just have so much more awareness of what they're feeling and going through in their lives. And I'm just so grateful for that. I'm just so happy that I have that now in my life. So that's just kind of where we're at now. Oh, I think that as a couple, this is just such an incredibly hard thing to go through. A member of my close family. So I have a sibling that struggled with some church stuff as well. And somebody in our family went up to them and said, you know, you're taking the easy road out. You're choosing the easier path. And it just was so funny to me that people think that this is the easy choice. When you stop going to church, it's not about having more time in your life. It's like, oh, well, you have all this free time now. That doesn't mean it's easier. Like, I look at the people who talk about us and question the choices we've made. And it's just such a hard thing to go through. We have not. So the whole story with the harassment, I've told maybe a dozen people, and that was really hard for me to do. That was really hard to open up to a couple of friends and a couple of family members and say, this is why I'm taking a break right now. This is why you're noticing that we're different, you know, that we're struggling right now. So for me to come here and do this, it's a big deal. And I know that, I mean, I'm guessing that most of the people in our old ward probably don't listen to your podcast. So sorry.
What a surprise.
What a surprise, because they're believers and that's great. But this, you know, there's been a lot of gossip about us. You know, I think that obviously on Facebook, I'm not posting pictures of going to church, not posting religious things. Well, I never did anyway, but it's certainly, I had a friend come up to me who I hadn't seen in a long time. And she said, it's very obvious there's something going on. Like, your lifestyle is very different now. And just not in a bad way, just, you're just focused on other things. She's like, what's going on? So I know that there has been talk about us. I know that there has been some gossip about us, and some fine and some not fine. We've run into people in our old ward that just were like in shock to see us and were very awkward. And I'm like, okay, you could be a little bit more professional about that. And it's hurtful. It's very hurtful, but it's okay. It's okay because I know that I'm a good person and I know that I'm happy and I know that I have a really, really great spouse that supports me and loves me unconditionally. And that's really all we want, is just to be loved unconditionally, to recognize that we too have hard lives and that this has not been an easy thing to go through. So, anyway, if anyone from our old ward hears this, just know that we're happy people and that we're still good people. We still make good choices. We still are good parents. And whether people recognize that or believe that or not, it's okay. Because I know what I know. And I know that, that we're going to make it and we're going to be fine. But yeah, it's been interesting.
Well, thank you. I can tell you found some peace.
Or I'm just really tired. Yeah.
No, I appreciate it. I think a lot of people relate to your story. One thing I have been learning a lot about is shame and how shame is in a lot of religions.
Yeah.
And I think especially with Mormon women in particular. And shame thrives on secrecy. It can't grow without secrets. And when you let that go, it loses some of its power. So I think people will relate and see themselves in your story.
Yeah. Yeah, that's so true. Just the peace that I feel, the guilt, just letting go, not just of the shame, but of the guilt. It's such an incredible feeling. I would sell it if I could. It just feels so good to live my life and know that I'm doing the best I can, and that's okay, and that there's no eternal... Okay, one more thing that I just thought of. The thing that I struggled with the most when I was LDS was Heavenly Mother. The things that I was taught throughout my life in the Mormon Church was that we have a Heavenly Mother, but we don't talk about her. We respect and love her so much that we just don't even go there. And I just remember one day thinking, my kids were really little. This is several years ago. And I remember one of my kids was just so angry about something and came up to me and just like smacked me. And typically you react to that. You're like, don't do that. That's inappropriate. That's not okay. And I just remember thinking, I'm just so glad that my kids have someone to come to. Not that it's okay for them to react that way, but I'm just so glad that my kids have someone that they can react to, that they have someone that loves them so much that despite the way you treat me, that despite the way you react to me, I still love you and I'm still here for you and I'm still going to talk to you and hold you and love you. I don't want to be part of an eternity where my children can never rely on me for help or assistance. Sure, it is so great that LDS people have a Heavenly Father they can pray to, but what about your mother? Don't you just want to say, I miss you, I need you, I love you, I hate you? I want to, whether there is an eternity or not, I don't know. I have an agnostic kind of perspective on what I don't know what I believe anymore, but that's okay. I believe in, happiness, and I believe that if there's a next life, that's just so great. Thanks so much. But I don't, if the Mormon heaven is real, I don't want anything to do with it. I don't want to have billions of children who can never turn to me for help. That's not what a mother is. That's not what a mother does. I just don't want any part of it. And when I realized that I didn't believe it was true and I knew it wasn't true, that was my number one thing. Thank goodness that I don't have to live eternity never being available to the people I love. Anyway.
You've mentioned a few times a little bit about feminism and then Heavenly Mother. Did you have feminist views while you were in the church, or did this come about after?
I always had these views. When I wasn't raised with these views, so I didn't have them until after I was married, and I didn't have them until I was a mother myself. But when I first went to the temple, I learned about, I'm actually second place. And then, I adopted it because socially that's just kind of what you do. That's how you're accepted. But it just kind of ate at me throughout my entire marriage. And I think when my husband served as bishop, it just got so much worse because I was very much, a bishop's wife is very much a number two kind of role. It's not even a calling. I don't even know why, like the whole mother of the ward, I want to, that makes me crazy. It's not a calling. It's not a position.
I'm not your mother.
I'm not your mother. So I've always considered myself a feminist. And the thing that I loved about my husband when he was a bishop is he's a feminist too. You know, the hard thing about his role as a bishop was they actually don't have that much control. My husband's like, I would love to give you more funding, but I'm actually not in charge. So issues with feminism, that wasn't a hard sell for him. That wasn't a hard thing for me to convince him of or just share with him, because he's always been so respectful of women. He's always been like, yeah. I mean, I work full time now, and I'm no longer Mormon. This is what I do. This is just an opportunity that came around, and he was like, this, you'd be great at this, but I support you either way. So he's always been very supportive in that role of, if you want a career, have a career. If you want to be home, be home. Whatever you feel like you want to do that makes you grow as a person, then that's what you should do. So, and here's the thing about feminism is so many people think it's just one defined role. It's not. I've never met two feminists that are the same, which is great. We should be different. So do I believe in the whole ordained women? Well, yeah, I think that sounds really great, but I don't believe in Mormonism. So I don't support that because I think those girls should just go away and be happy, you know, just go live happy lives. I feel like everybody should do that. So I'm not necessarily a supporter of feminism and Mormonism because I don't participate, but I believe in equality. I believe in that, we should be treated the same, no matter what color we are, no matter what sexuality we are desire, no matter, you know, man or woman. I just think that that's life, is equality and fairness. Is not necessarily, it's like perfection. There's no such thing, but we should be striving towards it. We should be striving towards people feeling like they have the same opportunities and the same things. And we are, as a society, we're doing so much better with that in terms of careers, but religion is just so far behind. So yeah, I would like women to have the same opportunities as men everywhere. And that was something I always struggled with at church. But I never was outspoken because back then it was true. In my mind, it was true. And that's just not what you do. So I'm certainly more outspoken now. That's not because leaving the church makes you a feminist. It's just because now I don't have the guilt and the shame when it comes to discussing it. Now I can just, I feel like I can be more outspoken and just say, everyone should be loved the same.
Well said. Well, thank you very much, Natalie. I really appreciate the time.
Oh, thank you.
That you gave me. And voices. All right. And again, feel free to come to MormonExpressions.com and spend some time there, and you can listen to all of our podcasts.